just invest. It's still a great thing to do. I know it can be scary to a lot of people. Jason's been doing this a long time. He's got a lot of knowledge. We're in an age of technology, and everything's at our fingertips. You can do a lot of homework on your own, but in the end, make sure you're talking to professionals like Jason.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome and thank you so much for joining me today. This is your host, Jason Hartman, with episode 1107, 1107. Great to have you here today. I've got our in-house economist, Thomas Young, with us. Thomas, welcome. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. And you're coming to us from Salt Lake City, Utah, right?
Correct.
Great. How's the weather? What's the temperature there now? Is it getting pretty cold?
Oh, it's cold.
Cold? How cold is cold?
Time to go skiing cold.
Yeah, oh, really? Yeah. You have the best snow in the world there in Park City, not too far from you, because it's nice and dry. But yeah, what's the temperature like today?
Oh, it's about 30 degrees.
Well, hey, I want to first answer a question that I got from one of our brilliant listeners, and maybe I presented this in a slightly confusing way. I am frequently talking about my own portfolio and what I'm doing with my properties, buying and selling or 1031 exchanging, and I may have confused you. At least I know I confused one person who asked me about it, and here was the confusion. I mentioned that I was buying a personal residence. Now, as everybody knows, I am a big fan of renting a high-end personal property and then owning, and that's to occupy myself, and I recommend that other people do that, and owning a lot of lower-end properties that you rent to other people because you arbitrage the rent-to-value ratios, meaning on the lower-end properties, the rent-to-value ratios are really favorable to the landlord, and on higher-end properties, expensive properties, the rent-to-value ratios are very much in favor of the tenant. But since I moved to Florida about 6-7 months ago, I have tried to find a high-end rental. And I got to tell you, in the Florida market, that was no easy task. It was pretty difficult. And I have a new theory as to why that is. Thomas, you may have something to say about this, actually. My theory is that the rise of Airbnb has sucked a lot of these higher-end, higher-priced rental properties out of the normal long-term rental pool where I might want to lease a property for 2 or 3 years or maybe 4 or 5 years if I really like it. A lot of these have converted to short-term rental properties. Now, I've got something to say about that because I think the Airbnb market, and Thomas, I know this is one of the projects I asked you to look into, do some research on for us. I am feeling that that market is pretty oversaturated. But that's another discussion. The way it affects me, though, as a potential tenant looking to rent a high-priced property for myself to occupy, the inventory has just been pretty limited. So I've been pretty disappointed. So I broke down and I bought a home for myself. Okay, I didn't want to do that, but I kind of talked myself into it because I was, number one, just weary and tired of the search for a home. And number two, because the property I purchased really would have a fairly decent rent-to-value ratio if I ever rented it, which would be about a 0.7 rent-to-value ratio. Not great, but not bad either for a brand new nice home that I actually liked. And so I broke down and I bought a house for myself. And Florida also has very favorable homestead laws, and it's a no-income tax state, so there are some offsetting factors there. But at the same time, I talked about how I was doing a 1031 tax-deferred exchange on an apartment complex I own with one of my clients. These are two totally separate transactions because one of our listeners said, Jason, how can you do a 1031 exchange on a property you occupy? Totally separate, okay? So I just wanted to clarify that in case that was confusing to anybody else. These are two completely separate transactions, totally separate transactions. So I am looking for a 1031 exchange upleg property. We sold this 139-unit apartment complex we own. Got to find something else to buy. So I'm on the hunt. If anyone out there has something, let me know. I know that the pickings are a little bit slim, but not as slim as they used to be, because in the commercial property market, that market is also softening, along with much of the residential market in the cyclical high-priced areas, which we're going to talk about in a moment. I just wanted to clarify that these are two completely separate transactions that I'm doing, not connected with one another, so I hope that makes sense. Okay, Thomas, let's do a little year in review. It's the new year. It's always a good time to do a year in review and talk about what we're looking forward to in the new year as well. Tell us about what happened last year.
Yeah, so on the housing prices front, housing began the year white hot, and towards the end of the year, it ended with a thump in a few areas, but mostly just slower growth across the country. Most areas are still growing pretty healthy.
The question there is always, compared to what, right? Compared to the beginning of the year, it wasn't white hot like it was back then. It certainly slowed, and especially that, that mainly was in the higher priced cyclical markets, not in the low priced linear markets that we like. But it's still overall, the market is, it's still decent. It's not back to the levels, of very lagging sales that we saw during the Great Recession or anything like that, right?
Yeah, I'd say it's healthy and in a strong, sustainable position.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So there's always this thing when you look at housing numbers, when you look at statistics of inventory and sales, because there's this lag time, right, Thomas? Where it takes a while for a deal to close, number one, so maybe that's 45 to 60 days, and then for the deed to record and the various companies that gather statistics, companies like CoreLogic and all the rest out there, to actually publish those statistics. So, there's this lag time, right? And we don't know in real time what the market is doing when it comes to housing. It's not like the stock market, right?
Yeah, housing statistics are always, I guess housing starts and building permits, they arrive with a 1 month lag, a little more than 1 month lag, but most other figures come out with at least a 2 to 3 month lag.
And that 3 month lag is because of what I described, right? In terms of the time it takes for the deal to close, and then for the stats to be reported, collated and reported, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. So Americans lost some real wealth in 2018. Now, granted, the question is always compared to what? I mean, we were in the stock market, which was crazy how the stock market was just on fire. But most of that evaporated, didn't it?
So over the past decade, wealth has gone from around $60 trillion to—it was headed to almost $120 trillion before the stock market took a nosedive, and that wiped out at least $5 trillion in wealth, probably more than that. Mm-hmm. Some of it's come back today, but it's still a good deal down from the 120 number.
Right. But you certainly can't look at daily. Now, when you say wealth from $60 trillion to $120 trillion, of course, you're just talking about U.S. residents, right? And how is that calculated? Like, what does that number mean? Is it equity in real estate? Is it equity in the stock market? Is it savings? What do you mean by that number?
Yeah, I'm talking about just households, and the biggest component of wealth is real estate wealth. And next in line after housing wealth is stocks and bonds, liquid financial assets. So, the liquid financial assets, they dropped in value, but housing wealth is keeping things going.
Yeah, okay. So there's a lot more volatility in Wall Street type assets and those paper assets because they can be traded so quickly. And, whenever you have ease and speed of trade, when the trading is more frictionless, then the volatility increases. At least that's, you know, my thesis, because, you know, when you can trade a stock with a click of a mouse and, you know, trading a house or even a commercial property takes a lot longer than that. It's a lot slower. So that's what I love. I love that illiquidity because it gives you time to react, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So $5 trillion in wealth has basically just evaporated completely. But it sounds like you don't think this is enough to trigger any kind of recession, right?
Yeah, there's this never-ending debate among, you know, individuals that debate the issue on whether financial markets respond to deteriorating economic conditions or whether they cause them. And I think the market was responding to concern about corporate earnings in the first half of 2019. So the market was looking forward to the first half of 2019 and saying, well, earnings are not going to be as strong on a year-over-year basis. So, you know, let's sell now. But I think those concerns were probably overblown.
This is this chicken and egg thing, right? You know, so say that again. It's a cause or an effect, right? Just dive a little deeper into that, if you would.
Oh, yeah. The debate is whether stock markets can cause a recession. And I think if markets were to continue to drop another 20%, then, you know, the equity market could cause a recession. But right now, Main Street looks great. Today's jobs market came in at 312,000, much better than expectations. The overall economy.
Jobs are good. Okay.
Yeah. Economy wages are good. They're 3%. They're not at the 4% level, which would be a concern for, you know, rising inflation. Inflation is, it's actually trending down. So inflation isn't a big problem.
Which hopefully will stop the Fed from taking away the punch bowl. I don't know about you, but I think Powell and his buddies at the Fed have been really a bit too aggressive. I'm going to agree with Trump that they're trying to ruin his party. You know, I think they needed to raise rates, but I don't know if they need to do it quite as much as they have done. Or, you know, do you think I'm right or wrong on that one?
Oh, I think, you know, just in like a nonpartisan perspective, I think Trump has a point. The Fed raised rates once during the entire Obama presidency, one time, and then after the November election, they raised it again. So two times during the prior administration, and already during the Trump administration, rates have been raised seven times.
Wow. But really, you could call it eight, because what you said there was kind of interesting. You said after the election, but not Trump wasn't in the White House yet, right? Because, you know, there's about a 2.5 month lag before he actually, you know, takes office, right? So after the election, they raised rates right away. I mean, the stock market started booming after the Trump election. And then seven more times, and they only did it to Obama one time. Wow, in 8 years. And then look at the time frame, right? Because with Trump, it's only been, what, 2.5 years, 2 years now, right? Or
yep,
or, 2 years. Yeah, 2 years. Okay, so, and Obama had 8 years, only got one increase. And wow, that's amazing. Yeah.
I don't know what to say.
Yeah, Trump's criticism of Powell is fair, maybe, huh?
He's certainly got a point.
Do you think the folks at the Fed are Democrats?
You know, the other day I was looking at average rate hikes by presidency, and the three top presidents for rate hikes per year were Reagan, Trump, and Bush 2. And the three bottom were Obama, Bush 1, and Clinton.
Interesting.
So
there might be a pattern here. Yeah, that's pretty interesting. So employment. Okay, so job numbers right now look good. And you know what just burns me up? It just drives me crazy. Every headline I read, I open any newspaper, look at any online news, and it's all about the trade war. This is bad. That's bad. Blah, blah, blah. Am I missing something, or why is it that the media does not connect all these trade war discussions with a job market? I mean, look at the bad side of the trade war is that, you know, it could cause prices to go up, right? Well, it will cause prices to go up. So that's a little bit inflationary. The companies don't like it because, hey, they can't source everything as cheaply as they could. But it causes the jobs to come back to the U.S. and the wages for existing jobs to increase, which is clearly happening. You know, Americans haven't had a real dollar pay increase in about 41 years until now. I just never see the media talking about that in the same discussion as they're talking about the quote-unquote trade war. Those two, I mean, am I crazy or aren't those connected?
Yeah, they are. You know, manufacturing jobs are starting to come back, and those are high-wage jobs. Generally,
they're union type jobs. They're high wage, blue collar type jobs, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So one sentence to remember in terms of last year.
Yeah. If there was one thing I had to say that would be worth remembering, it's the longer inflation remains subdued, the longer the expansion will last.
Okay.
If inflation remains subdued, that pushes the Fed off from raising rates and puts less pressure on stock markets. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If inflation trends down like it is right now, the expansion will last longer than it otherwise would.
You know, something I've always wondered about, I wonder if a volatile or declining stock market, now, of course, that's a wealth effect question, right? So when people have real estate and stocks or any asset that has increased, cryptocurrencies for, you know, they're a disaster, right? But any asset that has increased in value, right? There's this wealth effect, meaning that everybody just feels richer and they feel like, hey, you know, I'll take some more risk, I'll spend some more money. And there's this stimulating effect to that. And of course, the wealth effect is a major thing. There's no question about it. It's very important. But I've always wondered if a declining, flat, or at least volatile stock market is actually better or worse for real estate. You know, of course, if people lose all their money and they don't have anything to invest, then, you know, forget it, right? No wealth effect. But if they're as a wealth effect, but stocks start to get a little ugly like they have lately, does money flow out and flow toward real estate, or is it just bad overall when the stock market is stumbling?
Yeah, my initial reaction is the individuals that are in real estate for investment purposes, a volatile stock market or a flat stock market would certainly cause them to shift to real estate. Comparing the magnitude of that effect, it's a bigger universe, the owners of real estate and the owners of stocks that just plan on staying where they're at.
Mm-hmm. This one's a toughie. It's just anecdotal. I'm,
Yeah, it's a question of size, right?
Yeah,
which one's
right,
bigger,
right,
the
exactly.
investors coming in or the homeowners that have a wealth effect that now don't spend the money because they don't have the money. Yeah,
right.
Because they're losing wealth.
Can't spend what you don't have, exactly. But if credit is available, you can always spend it on credit. You can get a mortgage or buy your stocks on margin, right? So in terms of this year, the new year, what do you expect to see from the Fed?
Yeah, so they raised rates four times in 2018. I'd be surprised if they got another two, which would put the upper range of the federal funds rate at 3%.
Mm-hmm. How does that look historically, by the way?
Yeah, rates are still low by historical standards.
Right.
We've never seen a recession with the federal funds rate below 4%. Mm-hmm. So there's still room. They've already been aggressive at raising rates in the past 2 years. So I'd be surprised if they're as aggressive in 2019.
Yeah. There's been so much talk, and I just did an interview which has yet to be released, but it's a fascinating interview by the author of a book. His newest book is called The Future is Asian. And there's so much talk, Thomas, about China and, you know, trade and all of this stuff. Does China matter? I mean, of course it matters, but how much? Right?
Yeah. The theory up to now was that the U.S. could decouple from China and, you know, would not need Chinese growth in order to keep things chugging along. It looks like that's going to be tested in 2019.
Yeah. What do you think that test would yield, though? I mean, it's interesting, and I've talked a lot about it, really criticizing Peter Schiff for his, you know, theory that he's been totally wrong on, you know, a few things. And one of them is he kept saying before the Great Recession, well, China is going to decouple from the U.S. because they're creating their own consumer class. They won't need us to buy all their stuff. And, you know, that prediction sucked. There's no way that could happen, right? But the other way around, I mean, if someone is going to become isolationist and decouple, I'd say the U.S. is probably, I'm not saying it's a good idea. I'm just saying if it happened and if every country started to act that way, the U.S. would be in better shape than anybody else. At least that's my opinion. You may disagree, but thoughts?
Yeah, oh, I agree. Right now, I don't know if it's a lose-lose battle or not. The U.S. looks pretty strong right now.
Yeah, I agree.
It's definitely worse on China than it is on the U.S.
Right.
Their consumer, which had been growing at double digits for the past 15 years, looks like is going to drop to maybe as low as 5 or 6, 7%.
Yeah. What are you talking percentage? What do you mean when you say what percentage?
Oh, I'm talking about year over year growth in mm-hmm. retail spending in China.
Okay.
So retail spending had been early on in the 90s, it was 20-30%. Mm-hmm. And then it trickled down to, you know, in the past few years, it's been 11-12%. And now it looks like that could drop even more.
Right.
You know, 6-7%.
Yeah. And as much of a miracle as China has been and India has been and, you know, basically globalization pulling about 300 million people around the world out of poverty, thankfully, that's a great thing. Those countries have a long, long way to go before they create a consumer middle class anywhere, even that fathoms the United States. I mean, the U.S. has got the, for better or worse, the biggest consumers on planet Earth by a mile and a half, you know, by miles and miles. I mean, it's not even a contest, you know, but certainly they are growing it. That's definitely a change. No question about it. I watched an interesting video the other day on the Chinese ghost cities, and I've reported on that on prior episodes. Fascinating thing about these ghost cities, you know, where they just build these buildings and they're all vacant and everybody buys these units and they're all just vacant units and in high rises and they just sit there. Crazy, you know, but I guess that's how they stimulate their economy, right? Building stuff nobody needs.
In measuring economic growth, it works for a while, but then it doesn't.
Yep, then it doesn't. Very good way to put it. Very good way to put it. So equity markets don't cause recessions. You talked about that. If you have anything to add, what else? You got a couple more bullet points for the new year.
I think debt will continue to be an issue. Mm-hmm. Right now, the credit spreads between junk bonds and investment grade bonds is still in a healthy area. There's no signal yet from the debt markets that you know, the economy is going to go completely south in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
And the yield curve's still positive, although for a little bit there, it came close to flipping negative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, economists typically use the yield curve as a
recession predictor. Yeah.
If that is the case, then that still means the recession's 2 years down the road. It gives a lead time. But since approaching negative, it's flipped back to more positive.
Yeah. And, you know, we should do an entire episode on the yield curve. I think we should really take a deep dive into that in the future. I took a bit of a dive, you know, maybe a 10-15 minute dive into it just myself on a monologue on a prior episode. But I'd love to do that with you. So let's plan on doing that in the future, okay? Because it's interesting when you look at, you know, what the yield is on long-term debt versus short-term debt, how that impacts the economy and why it's been a, you know, a historical predictor of recessions and so forth. So so we shall see what happens there. All right. Well, hey, you've got a ton of graphs and supporting material here. And we will go into that, all 28 pages of it, Thomas. So thank you for that. In future episodes and on the website at jasonhartman.com and jasonhartmaneconomist.com as well. Thanks for joining us today. Any closing thoughts as we wrap it up?
Oh, life's good.
Good. So you are an optimist, right? Even though you are one who studies the dismal science. Good stuff. All right, Thomas. Hey, thanks again for joining us.
Good talking to you.
Welcome to the January edition of the Mortgage Update. This is Adam with us today as one of Jason's preferred lenders. How are you doing today?
Not too bad. What's happening, Adam?
Oh, just getting through the holidays and getting ready to start the new year off right. So for those investors who are looking at buying a investment property at the new year, what kind of rate are we looking at?
You know, we've dipped down into the high fives from what was the low sixes just a couple of months ago. And actually and of course, depending upon loan size and a few other things. So I tell everybody still budget right around the 6% range, but more than likely we're going to be a bit lower than that the way the market has been reacting since the last time we had talked. But if you're budgeting for a little bit higher and you're running your numbers there, you're a little bit more confident in your deal as you're going into it.
Now, I assume the drop has been due partially to the stock market tumbling. Is that what you're attributing it to?
There's a lot of movement in the mortgage-backed securities market in the last few months. Actually, it really started to turn around in early November. It was a slow climb, and then it just really started to make the slow movement to where it crawled back out of a pretty deep hole, probably the deepest hole we've seen since the crash. And we've gotten more to a stable position that we had seen back in August. And so it did that with a lot of money fleeing the stock market, which is interesting. It's the first time we've seen in a long time that money fleeing the stock market did make its way into the mortgage-backed securities. And I think a lot of it had to do with the equilibrium of the Fed slowing down their contribution to those pools with the quantitative tightening, and then the market kind of taking over that position and putting enough in to affect the market positively rather than the negative of the Fed not subsidizing it having such a negative effect on it.
Now, back on December 4th, the two-year and the five-year actually inverted for the first time. I think I read in about 10 years. How did that impact the market when that happened?
I don't know that it has had its effect yet. Now, interestingly enough, there is an article that was put out on Bloomberg today that the inverted yield curve not only signals a recession, but there's a belief that it's going to actually cause it, just the fact that it's there, right? And so it has rebounded back out of that. So it touched it just for a second,
right,
and then came back out. So they're no longer inverted. I don't know that that has actually had any real effect yet, but the fact that they've seen it, the market has seen it, the market acknowledges it, that's what's going to actually have the negative effect on growth going forward and the negative effect in the economy because it's happened.
So how has the mortgage market been influenced by the current climate between Trump and the Fed? Do you think that's impacted rates in any way, or looking out in the future, obviously?
It impacts the stability part of things. When you start seeing the two individuals kind of back and forth in that manner, it does continue to show instability in a sort, and I would think that would contribute to what's happened in the markets. So you start seeing what's going on in the stock market. We're getting ready to go into, and it looks like just yesterday they had staved off for at least a short window of time that bear market because of that massive move that happened in the stock market. And I think that's the main thing that we're dealing with here is just people are unsure of what to think of the future, and they feel that there's a lot more uncertainty because of that. And I don't think that's not the only factor. There's a lot of factors, but that's a big factor. That's a big thing when you have two major heads there that are not getting along. They're slugging it out in that way. And then, of course, you've got what's gone on with the Secretary of Defense and that whole situation going on. Just anytime you have that kind of thing, it just creates more uncertainty. And I believe that that's being seen in what's going on in our stock market. Yesterday, with that heavy trading, and we got to see where the stocks had ended so high on the day. It's one of the biggest trading days in history. But we also show, when you look at the charts, that it wasn't a trend direction change. It seems like it was just normal trading, but it was heavy emotional trading. And that's why, we saw the mortgage-backed securities market didn't react very negatively to it. Had a negative reaction, but not bad. We gained back all that negative and then some today. So we're in a much better territory than we were yesterday in the mortgage-backed securities. And we lost a good chunk of what was, I think, almost half of what was gained in yesterday's stock market was lost today in open trading. So, I think the direction for the economy is still going to go the way that the inversion is signaling. We're looking at some potential recession, or we're definitely looking at some recession according to all the analysts I'm watching and all the analysts that are downloading data to where I can see it. And then, of course, with the mortgage-backed securities gaining back so much ground, there's potentially we might see interest rates continue to improve. They've definitely improved off their worst levels, but then they continue to improve. And the one thing I continue to say over and over and over again to the real estate investor, interest rates would be damned. You need to find the deals that work for you and get involved, because financing real estate is the most tax-favored asset class that there is. You've heard that, I'm sure, many times on this particular podcast or any associated with it. That ownership of the property, renting out something or buying something that stays rented out and having a third party pay off the note is where the real value is. Not the cash on cash return, not the cap rates, not the cash flows. It's the paying off of the note. That gain, that increasing the initial investment by 5 times the initial investment just by paying off the note on a 20% down deal is where the real value is, more so than anything else.
Now, the Fed has decided to raise rates after a whole lot of people thought they might take December off and not raise rates. Has that changed your thoughts about what they're going to do next year, or are you still expecting them to raise, I think, what did they say, 3 more times in 2019?
Well, that raise was already baked in, so it didn't affect us negatively at all. I know many people that I have open files with were contacting like crazy the 2 days leading up to it. So they're going to raise, let's lock. Well, we look at their file and strategically decide whether or not it made sense to lock based upon when they were expected to close or the rehab was done or whatever circumstances around that property. And we counseled about that and decided to float it out because it was already baked in. You know, and I instructed them, they baked in that raise. So that's not going to negatively affect, or shouldn't, let's put it that way, shouldn't negatively affect the rate that they were getting. But what if they didn't raise it? It would actually make the rates get way better because they were going opposite of where we thought they would end up going with it. And so since it was already baked in one way, we knew it improve it. We would believe it improve it the other way. So that kept a lot of people, albeit anxiously, sitting on their hands and watching to see what happened. And it worked out to where we didn't see a negative effect, just as we had thought it would be when they raised the rate. Now the analysts are sending out in data to us that their belief is that the Fed would probably taper off of their plan next year based upon certain statements that have been made. Also, because one, going back into the inversion of the yield curve on the treasuries and all these other things, we are going into a recession at some point. Now, that being the case, what the Fed chairman, Jerome Powell, has done is has rapidly raised rates so that way they can taper off the rates if we do run into a position where we have a need, rather than going back to the old drawing board and ripping out from the old plan of doing the quantitative easing. Their plan is what we do is just lower rates, and that should spur it. So that way they don't have to go back into the quantitative easing by dumping money into the economy. So if you rapidly raise it that way, and then you can back off of it, it should have the converse effect, which is spurring the economy. That's at least what's been downloaded to me as far as information about that. Does that mean it's going to work that way? I don't know.
So they're looking to be both the hero and the savior?
Exactly. And so what's happening here is they're rapidly raising it, creating in a way, well, I guess it's kind of like they know we're heading to a brick wall. So they're putting their foot on the accelerator. So it's kind of a different thought process. If you're going to a brick wall, you stop or you turn, right? They're like, nah, let's just get to the brick wall faster. And so that's what they're going to do.
We'll fix the car after we hit the wall.
We're going to get this wall. Exactly. We're going to trash the car and everything else. And then we're going to start lowering rates. And we're going to see if that's going to spark things back up and get us moving again. Make it more affordable to buy a new car, I'm guessing, is how you might as well look at that. So that's kind of the theory behind what's going on, at least as I understand it. I've not sat in any of those meetings, so I can't speak vocally about being a first-person experience. But the amount of time that I spend listening to different analysts, and I spend a lot of money, about $1,500 a year, to get access to these analysts and their charts and what they show is going on out there. And that's what I see they have downloaded to the world, is the plan that the Fed is trying to implement to at least keep our economy rolling after we hit some sort of slowdown that a recession will bring.
If they do decide at their next meeting to not raise, or even, they probably won't, but if they decide to cut rates, if they don't raise, what kind of improvement do you think we might see in rates?
That's a solid question. It's kind of hard to say. I think that they're just looking back on where we had come from when they started doing the quantitative tightening. And that was, of course, January or the end of really a year ago is when they started doing that. We may get to a point where we gain back about half of what was lost during that time frame. And so what I mean by that, is we were at a point where the Fannie Mae 4% coupon, which I follow and kind of see how that trades every day, back in January of 2018, January 5th, was traded at a value of 104.50 with the close. Today, we're sitting on that same security. We're sitting at 101.59. So as you can tell, 104.50 to 101.59, we can probably see getting back about half of what, well, I actually where it bottomed out was 99.53. So that's 500 basis points, basically. So we would probably get 250. I'm guessing somewhere in the range of about 250 of all that back. So it'd be somewhere right around the 102.70 to 102.103 is where we might end up as far as a total value in that particular security. Therefore, interest rates could see another, you know, 0.375% improvement, possibly, if in fact it follows that pattern. Now, I can't say that it will, but that's traditionally what I've seen. When there's something that moves enough, you might get back about half of that. Now, does that mean that we're going to have a complete reversal and the rates continue on a downward trend from there on? I wouldn't think that that will be the case. I think we're going to get back part of it, and we're going to see probably rents or rates on a much slower increase over time. Because that's going, what's going to drive the interest rates is going to be the amount of money flowing into those pools. Those pools, either they attract investors based upon what other options are available. Most of the times it's stocks or currencies, some sort of commodity. You know, they're going to trade in something else. But if that's where they believe their money is their safest, that's where they're going to park it. And it's kind of hard to say how long that's going to be the fair-haired place of investment.
All right. Well, is there anything else you feel investors need to know before we wrap it up?
I'll go back to what I always say. Find the best team to work with. You've got to know the right people. If you don't have the right people to work with, it doesn't matter what the market does. You could have the lowest interest rate with the cheapest of every part of it, the best priced house. But if you don't have a good team to help you structure and build your business and a good team to help you manage the properties that you're buying, then you don't have anything. Because it doesn't matter how cheap it is, you're still going to be throwing away money and getting nothing back out of it.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
All right, thank you, sir.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.